Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I am your host, Steve Anderson, and today our guest is David McHenry. David is the director of PACE, a Therapeutic Associates Physical Therapy and Sports Performance Center in North Portland, Oregon. He is also the lead PT and strength coach for the Nike Oregon Project, a running group renowned for international excellence in track and field, whose athletes have won numerous Olympic and world championship medals, national and world records. He graduated from Penn State University in 1999 and played quarterback on the perennial powerhouse football team. He earned his doctorate of physical therapy from Slippery Rock University in 2002. David is also an independent contractor for United Kingdom Athletics, the Nike Innovation Kitchen, Nike Running, and the strength and conditioning consultant for the University of Oregon Track and Field Program. He is a certified sports specialist, a certified orthopedic manual therapist, and a member of the Nike Performance Council. Welcome, David. It's great having you on the program today. Thanks for your time.
It's great being here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start out by you were a quarterback at Penn State a few years back. Tell us a little bit about that journey and how that came to be.
It was a little bit more than a few years back. It was quite a few years back. I graduated high school in 1995 and ended up playing football at Penn State for 4 years under Joe Paterno. An important time in my life. It really helped create some clarity as to what I wanted to do. You know, coming out of high school and the first couple of years of college, I thought that I was going to be the next Tom Brady. And about my junior year, I realized that was not going to happen. So I had to kind of refine my focus and look to something else to pay the bills for the rest of my life. And it became pretty obvious at that time when I actually sat back and I looked at what I enjoy and what I wanted to pursue. I knew that I wanted to be on my feet. I knew that I didn't want to sit behind a desk. I wanted to work with athletes, and I just wanted to continue to explore and grow within kind of a field of movement and performance optimization. So becoming a physical therapist was a pretty obvious choice.
That's awesome. Now, what did you think of, what was your experience playing with Coach Joe? I mean, that's, he's an icon in the game, and were you a huge fan, and did you love playing for him?
Absolutely a huge fan. I mean, just an amazing guy, really attentive to detail, taught a lot of really important life skills through the context of football. A lot of people that I know that played football for him really attribute a lot of their personal success to what they learned on the football field with him. So just an amazing guy, just full of integrity, expected everybody to perform at their best, and he modeled that by always trying to perform at his best. Such as an invaluable experience that I had with him and with the other coaches and with my teammates.
That's great. Who was the lead quarterback during your tenure there at Penn State?
There was a few. There was Wally Richardson, who was there for the first 2 years, my freshman and sophomore year. And then after that, it was, I think, Mike McQuarrie for a year, and then Rashard Casey and Kevin Thompson kind of shared the quarterback duties my senior year. And that was when I realized my junior year, Penn State brought in the number one quarterback recruit in the country. His name was Rashard Casey. And after seeing him play for the first week in practice, I realized that I would probably never start for the Penn State Nittany Lions. And that was when I had to recalibrate my priorities.
Reality is harsh sometimes, right?
Reality is harsh.
What brought you out west to Portland, Oregon? Seems kind of a random place to end up after you were at Penn State. How'd that happen?
Yeah, just looking for a new experience. Grew up in a small little farm town in the middle of Ohio, and went to college, obviously, at Penn State, did my grad school work at a university just outside of Pittsburgh. So I had spent, you know, the first 25, 26 years of my life in middle America, and I just wanted something different. And I had quite a few friends in grad school who were from the Pacific Northwest, and they told me that I'd really enjoy it. So in the third year of my graduate program, I did an internship rotation out in Eugene, Oregon, and loved it. Loved the company that I was working for, which is a company that you used to be the CEO for,
yes,
incidentally. And it was an easy decision to graduate and come back out. And I took a job at a clinic in St. Helens, which is about 45 minutes outside of Portland. And, you know, my intention was to come out here for about 5 years, make some money, pay down some of my school loans, and then launch off to some other grand adventure, maybe in Europe. But pretty quickly after I landed in Portland, I kind of found myself doing some really interesting things, making some good connections, and kind of started off on a journey that I continue to kind of to pursue at this point. So I sunk my roots, and I've been here ever since.
Well, the company you're referencing is Therapeutic Associates, and you came up with a concept for a physical therapy clinic, which was a bit outside of the box, working with coaches. And explain to listeners how you structured that that practice that now is North Portland.
Yeah. So, you know, it was never my intention to be a director, to be a business owner, and to really go down that path. I just really wanted to be a clinical expert. And that's really where I had kind of honed my focus. But after being within the company for about 6 months, I kind of stumbled on an opportunity within this performance enhancement facility that used to be in Portland. And the guy that was running it asked me if I'd be interested in opening up a clinic and working with their athletes and then kind of growing a sports-specific physical therapy clinic and then work alongside the performance enhancement portion as well. And I was really intrigued. I had no idea what I was doing. I took some business classes when I was in grad school, but I didn't pay attention, thinking that I would never really be a businessman. So I kind of circled back around, and I delivered that opportunity to Therapeutic Associates, to the shareholders and the board of directors. And I was really young at the time. I think I'd only been a PT for about 6 months. And I had what seemed to be kind of a crazy, out-of-the-box idea. But as I discussed it with kind of the key shareholders and the board of directors and the executive staff, I think that they realized that it was a low enough financial risk that it was worth taking that risk on me and kind of a crazy idea. So I had a lot of support from a company who really had kind of fine-tuned a model for outpatient physical therapy practice. And I was asking to kind of sidestep that model and to try to create something different. And I had tremendous support, especially from you, as I kind of went down that path. And I've had a lot of support since.
And so explain the structure. So now the way it works, now that you've have the clinic in North Portland, you have coaches that aren't employees, but they work in the facility, they train their athletes, and then they use space together. So just explain that a little bit, because I think it's not the norm, and I think people would be interested in hearing about that.
Sure. So I think that to contrast what I'm doing with the norm, I'll kind of talk a little bit about the norm first, at least the norm back when I was developing kind of this model within Therapeutic Associates. You know, the norm was to have a relatively small clinic, have an adequate amount of treatment rooms, and have a really small gym, if any gym at all, and for everybody to be an employee, a collection of physical therapists, and maybe some physical therapy assistants or aides, and then front office staff. And the model was really just to kind of dive deep into physical therapy from a rehabilitative context and kind of generate revenue in that capacity. But you know, my long-term vision was to really create kind of an ecosystem under one roof. And I knew that I had to do that by bringing in people that were kind of in the same world as physical therapy and movement as medicine, but were far enough outside of what we do as physical therapists that it didn't make a lot of sense to bring them on as employees. So at this point, we have a relatively large facility. We have three main components of the facility. We have the physical therapy clinic, which kind of has an open treatment atmosphere, kind of like an athletic training room, which works because most of our clients are athletes. We have a 4,000 square foot gym with AstroTurf and all the bells and whistles. And out of that space, the physical therapists can flex in there and work with their athletes as needed from a rehabilitation standpoint. But we have 10 strength and conditioning coaches and personal trainers that work out of that space as independent contractors, running their own business, doing a lot of their own branding, while they also co-brand our facility, the Portland Athletic Center of Excellence, and just doing amazing work. And I think that one thing that really allows that model to flourish is, I really want to make sure that the people that I have in my space are people that are really dedicated and committed to their profession and to the quality with what they do. And people that are willing to launch out, start their own business, and take that financial risk because they have a passion for what they do, I have found to be more likely to be a higher quality. So having multiple businesses under one roof, all sharing resources, all collaborating, sharing athletes, has become really successful for us. And then the third component of our facility is our biomechanics lab, our motion lab, which is kind of a new venture that we've just launched into in partnership with Deers Biomechanical, which is a German company. So, and then we have in the biomechanics lab over the course of time, we've had other independent contractors who have been doing different things with physiological testing, bike fitting, and various things. So the independent contractors that we have had and that we brought on board and that we work alongside with have been really instrumental in us creating a multidisciplinary ecosystem of professionals that can all work with athletes in a slightly different context.
Now, since this is a show about leadership, most people would say that organizing and managing people who aren't actually employed by you is a really tough thing to lead. How do you get everyone to be on board, and how do you get everyone to play by the rules?
I think it comes down to culture. And if you want to create a culture, you have to bring people in that you know that you want to work alongside. And that's one thing that I've always done is when I'm vetting people to come in as independent contractors or employees, first and foremost, I want to know that I really enjoy being around them just from a personal standpoint, because I'm going to be spending more time with them than I will anybody in my family for the most part. I mean, 40, 50 hours a week. So I really want to enjoy who they are, what they bring, and just kind of the passion and the drive that is the underpinning of what they do. And I think that if you build a business really using culture as the foundation, it becomes a lot easier to manage those entities once you're all sharing a space.
Yeah, that's very well said, very well said. And you said earlier that, you know, you were a very new professional when this concept came up, so to speak, and a lot of people didn't think you could make it work. I mean, that, let's be honest. Where does your confidence and fortitude come from at that young of age, and you just powered through it, and now you're a model to many?
You know, I'm not sure where that confidence came from. I think that I've always had this sense that if I follow my passion, I'll always be wealthy. And that doesn't mean monetarily wealthy, but you know, if I'm always following my passion and if I'm doing what I love to do, then I'm never going to work a day in my life, and whatever money I can make doing that, is just a bonus. You know, growing up in a small farm town in the middle of nowhere, I mean, everybody was lower middle class. And because of that, you know, making even a modest physical therapy salary made me feel like I was rich. So I've never really followed money. I've never really been driven by financial success. I've just always been driven by following my passion and partnering with people that also have passion that kind of align with mine, and growing and building things together.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. Now, you are the strength and conditioning coach for the Oregon Project at Nike. That means you work with the most elite runners in the world. And how did you develop that opportunity, and how did it come to be?
The opportunity really kind of fell in my lap. And it really started with, I think, Therapeutic Associates' willingness to take a risk on me as a young physical therapist, trying to open up a kind of a sports model of a physical therapy clinic. Because I was where I was, working with who I was in the facility that the clinic was started in, it just attracted coaches and athletes. So in 2003, we opened up that facility. In 2004, Alberto Salazar heard about what I was doing and then started sending in his professional runners at that point within the Oregon Project for me to help kind of fix and rehabilitate if they were injured. And I did that for a couple of years, and we had quite a bit of success. I was really attentive to those athletes. I went above and beyond the call of duty. And it just developed into a deepened relationship with me and Alberto. And then he started asking me to do small little segments of strength and conditioning work for some of the key runners before key events. And that turned into a success. And in 2010, that relationship evolved into me becoming the head physical therapist and strength coach for the Nike Oregon Project. And that role entails some rehabilitation. But the idea is that if I really work at the top of my game as a physical therapist, then I should be able to identify weaknesses and vulnerabilities and address them before they manifest as injuries. So a lot of what I do as a strength and conditioning coach is really built on the back of my clinical practice as a physical therapist. And then that's also evolved into me helping out with form optimization, and now me doing a lot of other work within Nike as an independent contractor, within their innovation department and with the research lab, and with shoe design and development. So it's really been an interesting path that's just continued to build as years pass on.
So your normal day-to-day every day is that you are in the clinic some of the time, but you also go to Nike World headquarters there in Beaverton and spend time on campus working there as well. Is that pretty much a daily routine?
Yeah, that's pretty much the daily routine, even though my daily routine is not much of a routine. It's pretty different every day. I don't work conventional hours. Most weekends I'm working. A lot of those weekends I'm traveling. But, you know, the one consistent element is that every Monday and Wednesday I'm in my clinic seeing athletes that are not Nike athletes for a couple of hours. Then otherwise, you know, I could be at Nike. I could be at the clinic a little bit longer. I could be in meetings. I could be traveling, chasing our athletes all over the world, just trying to make sure that they're getting the care that they need. So it's kind of an unconventional work cadence, but it's one that really works well for me.
So explain, I think you explained this to me before, so I hope I have this right, but you explained to me before that most runners definitely fight injuries at this elite level, and on the average, let's say out of the 12 months that they're a runner, often 2 months, a lot of these runners are injured. But your runners seem to have bridged that gap and are injured much less. So how do you keep your runners healthy, and what is your role as their coach? You explained it a little bit that you try and anticipate what might be an injury before it's an injury. But is that true that a lot of runners at this elite level fight a lot of injuries, and you've worked pretty well with keeping them healthy?
Yeah, and I really think that that's the greatest asset that I bring to the Oregon Project is injury prevention. And I think that as a strength and conditioning coach, that's what we as a profession really need to champion, is that we can keep athletes durable and healthy and keep them training in the sport that they love. You're absolutely right. Running is just riddled with injury propensity just because of the repetitive nature and the repetitive tissue loading that runners go through. And if you think about it, if a runner is having to kind of attenuate 3 to 5 times their body weight with each step, and they take about 180 steps per minute, 90 on each leg, and they're running for 60 to 90 minutes, I mean, that's just an incredible amount of repetitive tissue loading and microtrauma that can very easily develop into injuries. So the injury rates in runners are astonishingly high, more so than most other sports. So the way that we combat that is we keep all of our runners under a microphone, under a microscope. I'm always doing clinical evaluations, even when they're healthy. We're doing a lot of biomechanical testing within our lab and within the Nike research lab, so that we can start to pick out imbalances, weaknesses, inflexibilities, asymmetries, asynchronicities before they can manifest as injuries. Because most injuries in running are overuse injuries, and most overuse injuries, a runner starts to develop a small little imbalance for weeks, and then that imbalance starts to grow until you hit a threshold where tissue start to become intolerant of that loading. So if we can start to pick up on these inflexibilities, weaknesses, joint dysfunctions, contraction sequence issues, biomechanical imbalances early enough, then we can correct them and prevent injuries. And we've been really successful at preventing injuries in runners that are running up to 120, 30, 40, even 150 miles a week for some of our marathoners, and doing unbelievable amounts of intensity on top of that volume.
Yeah, that's really amazing. And as a physical therapist, you know, you feel like you're well trained for that. And do you find most of those imbalances, or however you referenced it, before it becomes injury, do you find most of that by observing them and watching them go through the workouts and the routines, or is it more of a testing evaluative type of a process that brings those out and forces you to do something to deal with it?
Yeah, I'd say it's a little bit of three different things. I think that it is watching them during the workouts, watching them while they run, trying to pick up on little imbalances or hitches that they might be developing that weren't there a day or two early or a week or two early. I think the bigger part is the clinical evaluation piece, where I've got to get them on a table. I've got to feel their tissue tone. I've got to look at joint range of motions and tissue flexibility and strength and stabilization strategies. So that becomes a really important part, is actually getting them on the table and doing clinical evaluations. The third part is, as I said, the biomechanical evaluations, where we actually get them within a motion lab, and we're calculating and quantifying really finite measurements of their kinematics. And that becomes invaluable because, you know, the human eye can only start to see imbalances when they become large enough that they're obvious. But imbalances, when you actually start to look at finite quantifiable numbers in a motion lab, start to become apparent far sooner than the human eye can catch that.
Yeah. So tell us some of the runners, athletes that you're working with now. Let's name drop a little bit. Who are you currently working with, and who have you worked with in the past?
The most famous athlete that I've worked with is a guy that I still work with. I've been working with him since 2010. His name is Mo Farah, and he's won just about every gold medal in the 5K and the 10K over the past 8 years, up until the last year or two when he's transitioned to the marathon. He's arguably maybe the best distance runner of all time. So he's kind of at the top of the list of runners that are at least famous. And I mean, I've worked with just dozens and dozens of these professional guys. Right now, I'm working with Galen Rupp and Jordan Hasse, which are two top American marathoners in the United States. Suguru Osaka, who's the top marathoner in Japan. Safwan Hassan, who's probably the number one female distance runner in the world. Yomifka Jelcha, who's one of the top three distance runners in the world. Matt Centrowitz, who was a U.S. gold medal winner in the 2016 Olympics. He was the first 1500 meter gold medalist in about 90 years for the United States. I mean, the list goes on. Yeah. I'm very fortunate to work with these
guys.
It's just
amazing at that caliber. And you travel the world with these guys. I mean, you know, you're sometimes in the Pyrenees, in France or Spain, and sometimes you're in Africa, you're all over the place. Tell us a little bit about that, and is it still fun when you get to travel with them like that, or is it time away from your practice and your personal life that becomes kind of a hassle?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll start by saying that it's really one of the most enjoyable parts of the work that I do with Nike, is that I get to travel to amazing places, and Nike pays for it and pays me to be there. And a lot of these places are places that I would never otherwise go, and it's just really, really amazing. The travel does get a little bit laborious at times. I mean, there are stretches of 3 or 4 months where I might be out of the country for 2 or 3 of those months in various places during our peak kind of competition seasons, especially during Olympics and World Championships. But that travel has taken me all over the place. Just in about 2 weeks, I'm going to go to Switzerland for about 2 or 3 weeks, which is a place that we normally station when we're in Europe. And then we'll fly into Doha, Qatar, for the World Championships, which, you know, I would never otherwise go to that part of the world, but Nike's going to take me there. Yeah.
Yeah. So and I've seen you interact with these athletes, and you know, I'm just trying to think of how to describe it to our listeners. It's just a relationship that you built. I mean, I can tell those guys really not only admire your skill and your abilities, but they absolutely like you, and you're kind of one of the guys. And just explain to us a little bit how you develop relationships with some really high-powered, probably very egocentric athletes.
Yeah, you know, I think the answer is remarkably simple. I think you just got to care. You know, if you care about what you're doing and you care about who you work with, that's going to really show and shine through with everything that you do. You know, I love my profession. I love the skills that I've developed. I love the people that I work with. I love the experiences that allows me. And because of that, I just feel like I'm satiated every day. And when I show up to work with one of my athletes, they know that I'm excited to do it. They know that I'm going to give them my full attention. And they know that I really care about their success and about their legacy. And I think that just becomes a very genuine underpinning of a lot of the work that I do. And I think that it's a really important part of what I do. And I think it's an important part of what we do as physical therapists. And I had this conversation with some people that I look up to is kind of clinical, that have reached that clinical mastery level within physical therapy. And, you know, they all agree that one of the most important things that you need to do if you want to be a master clinician is show up and really care about what you're doing, and that care needs to be palpable to the patient. They need to know that you're there for them, with them, that you're in it together, and that you really care about the work that you're doing together because you care about them getting better. So I think that that can't be spoken loud enough, but it's one of those nuances of physical therapy that you don't necessarily learn in school. It's not a skill that you're taught. It's not something that you pick up from con ed courses. It's just something that either you have it or you learn to develop it.
Yeah. So now, what about your relationship with Alberto Salazar? So here's a coach. He's training these athletes. He wants to compete and wants to have success for not only their careers, but his career as well. So how do you approach him and say, hey, Alberto, you got to pull back on this guy, or, you know, you got to reduce what you're doing here because of injuries or so on? How does that work and how does he handle that?
It works really well. And what I've learned with Alberto, which is what I've learned with most coaches and most athletes, is you can't just tell them your opinion as to what they should not be doing. You need to give them the why. You need to kind of educate them as to why pulling back is going to be in the best interest of their season and potentially of their career. And I try to make that recommendation as little as I possibly can. You know, instead of saying, you know, we're approaching a serious injury, we need to pull back on volume and intensity, I'll just recommend that they kind of switch the priority as to how much volume, how much intensity that they're doing, so that we can kind of stay under that injury radar. But, you know, oftentimes when I do have to make a recommendation to Alberto or to another coach or to an athlete that we need to be really cautious and careful and maybe back off on volume and intensity a bit, I spend a lot of time educating them as to why I think that's important and why it's going to create better long-term success.
And do you find that they listen to you? I mean, again, they must be so driven to be at that level. You know, it's like, well, are they going to listen, or do they just go forward and sometimes make mistakes?
You know, I think that 80% of the time they listen and they do what I suggest. The times that they decide not to, I don't hold it against them. I don't get angry at them. If I've told them what I think is going to be in their best interest and they decide to go a slightly different direction, I'm going to support them 100%, and I'll do what I can to make that the best decision that they could have made. So it's, you know, I really try not to have my ego tied up into the work that I'm doing with these guys and the outcomes that they have and the decisions that they make if it's kind of a little bit different than what I would recommend.
What do you think is the key factor in that elite of an athlete? Is it, you know, is it the mind and the motivation and the inspiration? Is it are they just freaks of anatomy that they have things that others don't? Do they just work harder than anybody else? What do you think really gets a Mo Farah and Galen Rupp and Centrowitz and all those guys to the level that they are?
I think there are multiple things. I mean, as I'm kind of like ticking things off in my head, I can think of four that I think are just the foundational attributes of these, of the best runners in the world that I've had an opportunity to work with. I think one, you have to have a genetic aptitude for it. Two, you have to have a lot of just inherent durability within your system so that you can train very hard and tolerate a lot of loading. And you can improve durability. But if you have a genetic aptitude, both for the sport and also a genetic predisposition to really durable tissues, that's going to really help. To have the genetic aptitude for adaptability. So some people adapt really well to a stimulus. Other people just take longer to adapt to a similar stimulus. And when we're talking about runners becoming the best in the world, it's just a series of exposures to a challenging stress that we're asking their body to respond to and adapt to. So some people just have an unbelievable ability to adapt to stress. Other people don't. And adaptation is really the underpinning of progression over the course of time within a sport. The last thing, which might actually be the most important, is grit. What Duckworth, the professor, talks about in her book and in her research, that one of the greatest indicators of success isn't necessarily intelligence. It's not IQ. It's not your grades. It's grit. It's the ability just to grind and grind and grind and get knocked down, get back up, get knocked down, get back up. And it's, you know, I think that that's really typified in a quote. And I forget the boxer who said this. It might have been Jack Dempsey. He said, a champion is somebody who gets up when they can't. which I think really sums it up. I mean, you have to be willing to grind. You have to be willing to hurt from a cardiovascular standpoint. You have to be willing to do that day in and day out and never question why you're doing it.
And these are professional athletes that this is a full-time plus job. I mean, it's not something that they do because they had an interest in it. This is what they do all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the group that I work with, at least at Nike, are all funded. They're paid primarily by Nike. They make other money from winning races and for appearance fees. But this is their full-time job, and they treat it as such.
How do you handle the pressure of, you know, I'm just trying to imagine that, you know, again, working with this caliber of an athlete and pushing them hard enough to reach their performance potential. Yet, you know, if they get hurt, the risk is really high, and it's got to be a daunting a thing for you to be in that position that you're kind of controlling that, you and Alberto together, I'm sure. But how do you just handle the pressure and the stress of that?
You know, the stress of that, the stress of my athletes performing, not getting injured, the stress of me making sure that I'm doing what they need to have done in a timely manner. I mean, there is a lot of stress there, but that's stress that I really kind of thrive in. Other stress, like business stress, you know, meeting financial expectations, that's stress that really kind of keeps me up at night that I don't enjoy. But the stress of being in competition and having my runners line up against the other best runners in the world with extraordinarily high expectations, I kind of thrive on that. It's something that actually lets me go to sleep at night rather than keep me up at night.
Yeah. You know, and you've been to all these events at the Olympics, you know, every 4 years and all the world championships and all that. Of all the performances of your runners that you can remember, which one stands out the most where you just were so elated and so excited and maybe surprised? What do you think is the best performance you've ever seen?
I'm going to have to say there were two. I mean, my first Olympics that I went to was 2012, after I had been working with a group for about a year and a half or 2 years. And Mo Farah and Galen Rupp came in first and second in the 10K. That will always go down as one of the top, if not the top, experience that I've ever had as an athlete or as a coach or as a professional.
And that was in London in front of, because Mo Farah is British, right? So that was in front of his home crowd. And I can remember watching it on TV, and you could just feel the excitement of the crowd just coming right through the TV. I can only imagine what it was like in the stadium.
Yeah, it was surreal. So that was one. The second would probably have to be Matt Senchowitz winning the gold medal in the 2016 Rio Olympics. Just because he was, you know, kind of an underdog and an American hadn't done it in so long. And he just ran a masterful race, very strategic, and just really was able to kind of showcase his talents and strengths and take advantage of the rest of the field's weaknesses. So that was probably another one of my top.
And that wasn't a surprise to you, was it? I mean, it's a surprise in the sense that wasn't he the first American in how many years to win that race? And then, but you felt he had it. But I think the national public or whatever wasn't aware that he was one of those guys.
Yeah, I think that we all realized that he had it. He had been training really well. He had been healthy. He was really fit. He was really fast. His workouts were mind-blowing. So we showed up in Rio knowing that if it was the right race and he made the right strategic moves, that he had a very good chance of winning. I think that we knew it, but I do think that it was a surprise to everybody else.
Yeah. So when you're at like the Rio Games and your athletes, you know, run and perform and then they're done, what's next? The party? Do you party with them? Is it, do they let go or are they just so dialed into their athletic endeavors that it's just another day at the office and they're right back to work?
You know, after the Olympics, after World Championships, at the end of a hard season, that last race, I mean, it's really just an adrenaline dump. You know, I mean, these guys are training and they're right on that red line of either popping off an unbelievable world-class performance or potentially getting injured. So they're just physically stressed, emotionally stressed. They've been traveling quite a bit. So as soon as their race is done, there's just a big release and relief of stress. they might go out and have a couple of beers, but you know, they don't go out and they don't get wild. I mean, they really approach it as a profession, and they know that they're going to take 2 or 3 weeks off. They're going to enjoy their families. They're going to go and hang out with their friends. They're going to get a lot of sleep. They're not going to have to run 120 miles a week. They're not going to have to lift with me 2 or 3 days a week. And they just use that time to really kind of decompress, and then they reload. And when they're ready to start the next training cycle, they show up and they're 100% invested.
And I think it's, even though these runners are, they're such, how do I say this appropriately? I mean, they're little guys. I mean, they're not big, bulky athletes, but they do a lot of strength training. They do a lot of, they need to be strong to maintain that, that performance. So what do you focus on, and what kind of things are they doing that might surprise the rest of us when we see them out running?
Yeah. When you watch a runner, if you meet a runner, I think that if you're not accustomed to that culture, that environment, it's pretty shocking how small and lean and frail that they seem. But that's really not the case. Running, just like most other sports, kind of reduces down to a very simple equation, which is power per kilogram body weight. How much power can they generate with a body weight that is kind of optimally low? So in order to do that, there are some strategies that and methodologies from a kind of a training standpoint, both on the track and doing hill repeats and doing all these other fast sprint workouts, and then really long, arduous strength-based workouts. But then in the weight room, there are things that we can also do to really optimize power per kilogram body weight. And that involves some heavy lifting. So people like Jordan Hasse, who is our number one marathoner in the United States right now, weighs about 100 pounds. That's her race weight. And she doesn't have much problem doing a deadlift of 205 pounds for a set of 2 or 3, which is astounding. If you see a 100-pound tiny little blonde girl in the weight room, deadlifting 205 pounds, you'll think that you're probably having a hallucination. But, you know, these runners, they lift hard, they eat well, and they do everything that they need to really optimize their ability to put force into the ground over the duration of their race, whatever length that is.
And I remember when I had the pleasure of interviewing Mo Farah, I believe he told us that his race weight in his prime is 116 pounds. That's unbelievable. I mean, that's he's just so slight, but yet, gosh, turn on the afterburners and it's a beauty of nature.
Yeah, and he's one of the guys that really took to the lifting quickly and really loved it and continues to really love it. When I took over in 2010 as a strength coach, we were entering into kind of a new methodology that had not really been adopted by the general running culture, of actually lifting heavy weights. I mean, the methodology up until then had been, you know, runners have to stay really lean, they have to stay really small. If they lift heavy weights, they're going to bulk up and they're going to get slower. But, you know, we leveraged some pretty good sports science and research to suggest that we could actually get our guys lifting heavy. It wouldn't create hypertrophy and increase their body mass. And we could actually get some strength and power adaptations without changing their body morphology. And Mo was the first one that jumped onto it, loved it, wanted to lift hard, wanted to lift heavy, wanted to lift more than 2 or 3 days a week, and has just really thrived.
Now, he's not getting any younger. He's, for a runner, he's kind of getting on the older side. Is he the Tom Brady of running? Is he just going to keep going? He seems like he's doing as well as he ever has.
Man, he could be. I mean, he's durable. He's always training hard. I mean, he's probably 34 or 35 right now, so he's definitely getting long in tooth. But, you know, he's still one of the best marathoners in the world. You know, he successfully went from the 5K to the 10K, and took about a year to really dial in the marathon. But at this point, if he's in a marathon, then there's a good chance that he's going to win.
And is that progression that you just talked about in the running world, is that perhaps because of his age that he's able to do the longer distances easier and maybe not the more sprint, or faster races? Is that an age factor there?
Yeah, that's kind of a normal trajectory for most runners that have a long life in the sport, is that they'll move up in distance as they get older. Just because as they get a little bit older, they start to lose some of their top end speed. But because of the accumulation of training volume over the course of multiple training cycles and multiple years, they could run longer distances at a faster pace. So it's not uncommon for somebody to move from the 5K to the 10K and then from the 10K to the marathon. It's a little bit less common to see somebody just show up as a world beater in the marathon without already having done 5K and 10K for several years at a very high level.
Yeah, interesting. Is it frustrating when one of your athletes gives just an amazing performance and then a lot of times the media or the public goes right to, oh, it must be drug-aided, or there's some, you know, is he taking drugs, or there's always, you know, somebody throwing out a spear there. That's got to be a little frustrating.
It's a little frustrating, and I'll answer that in a couple of different ways. It is frustrating, but I think that when you're the best in the world, you got a big target on your back, and people are trying to look for excuses as to why they can't beat you. So in some regards, when our guys get accused of doing things that are illegal or doing things that are against kind of the spirit of the sport, it makes me realize that they're targeting us because we are so good and it is so hard to beat our guys. And I almost take that as a little bit of a compliment. I know, having been within the Oregon Project since 2010, that there's no truth to any of those allegations. And, you know, for me, the most important thing that I have is my integrity, and I would never compromise that. So it doesn't really affect me, and I don't feel like I need to defend my athletes and the program against those accusations, because I know they're not true. And I know that people are looking for an excuse as to why our team is so good.
So why is your team so good?
I think one of the reasons is that Nike does a great job funding our program and funding the Bowerman Track Club, which is our kind of competing U.S. team. That's also a Nike-sponsored team. But Nike just puts a lot of money and a lot of resources into their runners. You know, what people might not realize, I think some people do, but what most people might not realize is that Nike started as a running company. Phil Knight was a track and field athlete at University of Oregon and was selling shoes, running shoes, out of his van. And, you know, that's how Nike started. And as Nike has evolved, and, you know, they have a huge hand in every sport in the world and in every country in the world, their root is still track and field. So they put a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of resources into providing great training exposures to their athletes. So our program in particular, I mean, we have about 12 athletes, 12 of the best runners in the world. And we have a slew of coaches. I mean, we have Alberto, who's the head coach. We have Pete Julian, who's the associate coach, who coaches half of our team. We have Gabrielle, who is our full-time massage therapist. We have me, who's the full-time physical therapist and strength coach. We have Darren Treasure, who's a full-time psychologist. There's a lot of resources for 12 athletes. And we have, you know, a lot of resources that other runners just simply can't afford because Nike is willing to provide them, like altitude training opportunities and recovery aids. I think that's one of the reasons. And, you know, also I just think that we have come up with a really good program within the Oregon Project. We have great people doing great things. And we figured out how to get the most out of our athletes.
You know, and from, you know, just my observation, it's, and they have sustainability. Those same runners have been top runners for multiple Olympics and multiple years, and they're still at it. Where a lot of times you see the African runners come up and, you know, have a great event or a great Olympics or whatever the race may be, but then they disappear. You don't see them again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a lot of that is just tied to durability. You know, if we can keep our athletes durable, we can keep them injury-free, we can keep them training, then they're going to continue to succeed. And I think that, you know, a lot of these runners that kind of show up and they burn really bright and then they kind of fizzle out, it's not because they've lost their talent, or maybe even not because they've lost their drive and their grit. It's just because their body can't tolerate the amount of training that it takes to compete at the international level. So, I mean, that's why for us, durability is probably one of the most important elements of the strength and conditioning program. So that they can continue to train year after year and compete year after year and really optimize their potential over their entire lifespan of their career.
Man, I got to tell you, you must just walk on that Nike campus once in a while and look up from some stadium somewhere around the world and look at all the fans and all the people there, and you just must pinch yourself.
Yeah, it feels surreal. I mean, I always have this sense of you know, am I in a dream? Because I'm really doing exactly what I have always wanted to do, but I never thought that I would get there this early in my career. You know, I thought that in the twilight of my career, in my 50s and 60s and maybe early 70s, I'd finally get the experience to do what I'm doing right now. And I've been doing it since I was in my late 30s. You know, I think that I was in the right time. I was in the right place at the right time. I had support from the right people in the right company. And when an opportunity came my way, I capitalized on it just by really showing up with passion and integrity and really cared about what I was doing.
Well, you know, I think you should also give yourself a lot of credit too. You talk about grit and you talk about relationship building and you talk about, you know, being at the right place at the right time. But those are just things that you have done very, very well and you're an expert at. And so I think it's not just, you know, luck by any means. I mean, you definitely developed it. And in your own right, you're at a high elite level in the PT world. And not everyone can do that. So I commend you for or just appreciate having the great fortune to just watch you go through it. It's pretty amazing.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
How do you tell, you know, a lot of young professionals, you know, struggle where they come out of PT school and they get in the clinic and it's kind of a grind and they wish they could be doing something different. They look at somebody like you and they say, well, that's what I want to do. But, you know, you didn't perceive that you would be doing what you're doing when you were a new professional. So what advice do you give to people that, you know, want to do something different or do something innovative and big and exciting, but they can't really see it where they are in their early career?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what I would suggest and what I do suggest when young PTs ask me that is, you know, follow your passion. First, identify what your passion is and figure out how to make that your profession. Come up with a plan and then just stay on that plan, persevere, and be willing to make some sacrifices. When I started out and I was looking to kind of create this practice and create this athletic ecosystem that we now call the Portland Athletic Center of Excellence, the intention was not to make a lot of money. It was not to create a successful business. It was for me to follow a passion that I had that I would pursue if I made no money at all. And I had a plan to do it. And I just never compromised my willingness to sidestep away from that plan. And you know, I think that a physical therapist can do that in a lot of different contexts. You know, if they're working in another clinic and they have a clinical director and they have an idea, they should really research how to execute that idea, propose it to the clinical director, get their support, get their consent, have a little bit of resources allocated to them and kind of follow it. You know, it's small steps lead to big steps and you just need to start taking the small steps in the direction that you ultimately want your career to go. You need to be creative and you need to be assertive and you need to be confident.
And you also need to be willing to take that risk financially and and even personally. I mean, do you feel like you sacrificed some on the personal side of who you are to get to where you are?
Financially, yeah. Early in my career, you know, when I was kind of building this model, the traditional approach that physical therapists would take and a lot of the clinicians in our company would take would to, you know, go and create relationships with physicians and have the physicians send them patients. And for me, I didn't want to go that route. And that route is a very successful route. It's really kind of the core competency of what we do as a company that's made us the largest physical therapy independently held company in the United States. But, you know, I just wanted to take a different approach, which meant that I wasn't going to see as much volume and not make as much money because I was trying to capture athletes and not anybody who was injured. So within the first few years of my career, I definitely didn't make as much money as I otherwise could, but I was still making plenty of money to, you know, pay my bills and enjoy my life. But, you know, now I'm making a lot more money than I ever thought that I would. And I've never had to compromise my passion to do it because I started down that path very early on. You know, I see some of my friends who, when they graduated from grad school, they took high paying jobs in a sector of physical therapy that they didn't really enjoy, thinking that they would just do that to pay down some of their loans, and then they would sidestep into kind of the area that they really wanted to practice. But I'd had conversations with several of them 5 years after graduating, and they felt like they were kind of stuck within the job that they were in because they were reliant upon the money that they were making. And they felt like they had lost a little bit of the skills that they were that they came out of grad school with to really go into an area of physical therapy that they were more passionate about. So I think that you know, passion always needs to be your North Star, and you can't compromise that, even though it's going to come at the expense of probably money on the front end of your career.
Yeah, great advice. So what's in the future for David McHenry? What are you just keep doing what you're doing and loving it, or do you got some bigger ideas, some bigger goals? What's going to be your path in the next few years?
You know, I love working with the Oregon Project. I love working with the athletes. I'm starting to do more and more work kind of within Nike, within their innovation groups and some of their research projects. I really enjoy that. I would like for that to continue to be a part of my future. We've just opened up this Motion Lab, which is really amazing for myself and for Matt Walsh, a colleague that is the co-director of the Motion Lab, because it's really allowing us to look at motion in kind of a high fidelity capacity that we've never been able to do. And we're learning a lot. It's really challenging a lot of our assumptions that I think that we hold as physical therapists that we've never been able to test. And now that we are testing them within our motion lab, we're realizing that some of our assumptions are accurate, but a lot of our assumptions are inaccurate, which is then kind of changing what we're doing from kind of a treatment strategy approach and a clinical intervention methodology. So I'm really excited about that. I think that, you know, if we as physical therapists are going to claim to be the movement experts in medicine, then we need to be the best at measuring movement. And right now, I don't think that we are. So I think that in our profession, our evolution is going to include having these regional high-fidelity biomechanical motion capture labs that we can all utilize within that community to really capture and understand movement in a way that's going to create much better outcomes.
That's great. And you have also worked with other athletes besides runners. I mean, don't you work with Dominican Sue? Did I say his name right? Who's like the total opposite of Mo Farah, and as far as the way their bodies look, it couldn't be more different, right? Yeah. So you work with him and others, and he's a professional football player in the NFL. So it's I imagine the principles are the same, but just different bodies to work with.
Yeah, you got it. I mean, you know, bodies are bodies and they all function relatively similarly. And, you know, some bodies need to be more competent at a different skill set, and that just influences how you work with them. And that's one thing that I really enjoy is that I'm not just working with runners. You know, I mean, running is a big part of what I do, but, you know, I'm working with professional football players, basketball players, soccer players, ballet dancers, just a whole slew of athletes that are tuning their bodies in a way to do something extraordinarily well. It's really fascinating, and I learn a lot from it. And that diversity really keeps me engaged.
So usually at this time in the interview, David, I kind of ask our guests, in relation to leadership, give us a pearl of wisdom. So what would your pearl of wisdom be to our listeners today?
A couple things come to mind, two pieces of advice that I've gotten, and then one thing that the Pete Julian, our associate head coach for the Oregon Project, told me recently. The two pieces of advice that I've gotten from a business standpoint that I think have really been helpful for me, one is, if you're an idiot, surround yourself with geniuses. If you're a genius, surround yourself with geniuses. So that makes it pretty easy. You always have to surround yourself with people that are amazing at what they do, and maybe more amazing at what you do. And that's totally fine. That's how you learn. That's how you challenge yourself. And that's how you evolve. Another one is find amazing people, give them all the resources they need, and then get out of their way. And that's one thing that I really feel like has been important for my leadership style, is that I find people that I can have a tremendous amount of confidence in, and then I can provide them the resources and just let them author what their professional aspirations look like, and just watch them succeed. I think the third thing that comes to mind is this concept that leaders eat last, which just means that, you know, as a leader, you need to be taking care of everybody that is working kind of underneath you and with you and for you before you start to take care of yourself. And I think that that's really important. Because if you're taking care of your team, then your team's going to take care of you.
Yeah, that's so awesome.
Those would be my three.
Yeah, and then you and your runners are probably gearing up for the next Olympics, not too far away.
Yep, so the next Olympics are going to be in Tokyo 2020. It's going to be really exciting. We have a really amazing stable of runners right now. If we can keep them healthy, we're going to win a bunch of medals. At least that's my hope. Yeah,
that's great. Well, David, I want to thank you for your time today. I've just been thrilled to watch you through your career and come up, as you said, as a new professional and come up with some great ideas and just stick behind them. And you're a master at pulling off what some think would be tough, and you do it with grace and elegance, and I'm just so proud to watch that and be a part of it in some small way. So congratulations on what you're doing, and I can't wait to see what comes next.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate that, and I appreciate all the support that you've given me. I mean, without your support, then this journey would have been a lot harder if it would have even happened at all. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Have a good rest of your day, and I appreciate you being on the show.
All right. Will do. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To hear the entire series of interviews, search iTunes Podcasts for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. To view videos of many of my interviews, search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also visit my website, which is orange.coaching.com, and that's orange, the word, .coaching.com, and go to the Media Center, where all episodes of the video and podcast episodes are available.